As Juan and I sit, a single message seems to be transmitted over and over in my mind. To the extent that we're all connected, the negative thoughts we hold toward one another, and simultaneously toward ourselves, are the equivalent of magic spells or curses that inflict damage until they are cleared. Consciousness is the only cure. We're souls from the same origin, encapsulated in flesh and bone. We strive for separation and private property on the physical plane, but it keeps us from understanding how powerful we are as a collective. Judgment of others comes from judgment of self. These patients have put all their faith in me, and I've allowed the perceived burden of this responsibility to keep me detached. But healing doesn't happen in a vacuum, and this separation may actually be inhibiting my and their experience. What happens if I just give over to the experience and stop creating so many rules for myself? Okay, says Roman suddenly. It's time for us to switch again. Thank your partner for the experience and find your next pairing. Juan nods and closes his eyes. I thank him and give him a hug. Download received. I glance up to see John, our prostate cancer patient, staring with wide-eyed terror into the smiling eyes of his gaze partner, Gretchen. The exercise is over, but the two are interlocked in a transmission that my gut tells me is too deep to even begin to contemplate. A minute later, she leans forward and gives him a big hug. The look of disturbance on his long face is replaced with one of sadness and gratitude. His eyes glass over and then close. Something is happening inside of our man from Australia. Final beams of light are bouncing off and through the tattered burlap curtain that separates the toilet stall that I'm currently occupying from the forest outside. An hour ago, San Pedro began to feel like grandma in my stomach, and I left the circle with comical but very real urgency, walking away hastily, then stopping to regain my intestinal composure, looking up at the group, waiting to let them know I was okay, and then continuing to awkwardly make my way toward the side door. I'm now seated on the bowl, in the throes of an uncomfortable but satisfying plant purge. Through a hole in the rough fabric, I see the ceremonial maloca looming against the wide, cloudless sky, its thatched steeple reaching almost as high as the palm trees that surround it. The energia of San Pedro is in my musculature, in my head, in my throat and ears, coursing through my arms and legs, running through my fingertips and the bottoms of my feet. It is said that mezcalito medicines give one great power, but if improperly used during ceremony, they can disorient, overwhelm, and terrify. The senses are heightened, the awareness even more keen, making me want to get on all fours and prowl the forest like a puma. Sometimes I do, but today is different. Sitting with all the patients in ceremony and working to dissolve our illusion in a sacred communal setting has me feeling soft, grateful, and somehow vulnerable. My ears key in on a new sound high up in the maloca, the ringing of strings being plucked over the loose rhythm of a hand drum. Roman's odd little guitar is the only creation capable of emitting such a out-of-tune yet entrancing melody. Looking up through the trees and into the screen chamber, I can see the silhouettes of half the people in the room, mostly sitting or lounging on the floor. But there is a tall and slender man shape off to the side, standing upright and moving, or flailing, in an uncontrollable manner to the music. Here we go. A few minutes later, I'm climbing the steps back up to the wooden octagon, the melody becoming louder and faster as I approach. In all honesty, I can't tell whether the music is actually being played at a higher tempo and decibel level, or if Grandpa San Pedro is playing tricks on me. The door creaks open unsubtly, giving way to an interior that is now awash with the warm glow of candlelight. As I enter, I look across the room to Roman, who is in a state of focus as his fingers move over the strings of his peculiar dwarf guitar. His eyes are trained on the spectacled body that has come alive across the room. It's John, and he's crouched like a gargoyle, with both hands stretched in front of himself, each finger shaking and recoiling at impossible intervals. His mouth is hanging open as he stares ahead, occasionally muttering to someone or something that isn't visible from where I'm standing. Ever so slowly, he begins to rise from his squatting position, face and animated hands, continuing their communication with the unknown. A minute later, he is standing fully erect, and his hands have traveled down to his sides. His expression is still blank, his eyes a mystery behind the glimmer of firelight on glass lenses. The disorienting, seemingly directionless music slips into a faster tempo, shimming up and down in a hypnotic loop. Roman is singing an Ícaro, but the sound coming from the shaman's lips has the rasp and labored delivery of an 80-year-old man. Roman's voice and music are coaxing something out of John that is uncomfortable to watch but impossible not to. The man is walking on some other plane, encountering new parts of himself, rediscovering the full range of motion and expression of his physical form. He is electric. I've seen something like this before. In the bazaars of Morocco, I once saw a Berber snake charmer play a similarly hypnotic melody to coax a cobra out of a basket and out into the open air. And like that, the music stops. Nobody speaks, and the evening sounds of the jungle begin to interject and regain hold of the space. All eyes are on John, supporting, not judging. This is ceremony. Swaying slightly in the night air, John looks down at one of his trembling hands and brings it up to his face. He inspects it for a few moments, as if it isn't attached to his body. Turning it frontward and backward, waving it back and forth, and with a look of realization coming across his face, stilling his animated fingers. He looks across the room at Roman, and then at all of us, and nods, closing his eyes, and bringing his hands up to his heart. His eyes remain closed and his head bowed as he lowers himself into a crouch again, hands moving into a self-embrace as he begins to rock himself backward and forward on bare feet. Roman rises, crosses the octagon, and crouches down too, mirroring John's posture. There is nothing comical about this. We are witnessing a shaman deep in his work. Sensing Roman in front of him, John's head lifts slightly and his eyes open. Thank you, Roman. Roman brings his hands up to the sides of John's cranium and pulls it towards his own until the two men are touching foreheads. Eyes closed, he begins to speak quickly and indecipherably, rocking back and forth. The two are in a momentary trance together before the shaman slowly leans back and looks into the other man's eyes. Yeah? Roman asks. Yeah. The two embrace and begin to laugh. I get up and begin to move awkwardly toward the exit again, stopping mid-octagon and bending involuntarily to hunch, staring downward, hoping the content of my bowel stays put. Roman looks up, noticing my predicament. Brother, is there something of interest on the floor there? This elicits a smattering of giggles from John and the others. Not yet. Eye gazing. The eyes are the windows to the soul. Unknown. We have these two orbs in our head, through which we see and recognize the reality around us. They are capable of distinguishing the most minute details of our surroundings and interpreting the slightest discrepancy in another's countenance to distinguish mood and intention. And yet, we rarely turn our pupils directly upon another set. It's uncomfortable to make eye contact with someone for too long in normal conversation. But what is the source of that unease? What don't you want to show that person? What don't you want that person to show you? As we often find on this path, there's a cultural context obstructing our way here. The notion of eye contact bespeaks a variety of social do's and don'ts, based on the connotations of physical intimacy. This is another checkpoint on the medicine path for many. A place to become aware of and step over your ego. The beauty of this exercise is that it's alarmingly simple to do, but it's so rarely done, even with those with whom we are most intimate. There's real power to doing this with someone you're already in close relationship with. Friends, lovers, mothers, fathers. But it's just as incredible to do it with a complete stranger. You'll be surprised at what the experience can bring you. It rarely disappoints. The exercise. This works best when both parties are already de-stressed and fully present. So do whatever you need to do to achieve this state. A 15-minute meditation, yoga routine, breathing exercise, long walk in nature, or your favorite variety of the hot-cold therapy mentioned at the end of Chapter 4 would work well here. Step 1. Set a timer for 10 minutes. Step 2. Sit across from your partner, preferably cross-legged, on a soft rug or cushion. Step 3. Close your eyes and take a few deep breaths. Step 4. Open your eyes and look into the eyes of the person in front of you for 10 minutes. Step 5. Let the muscles in your face and body respond naturally to whatever is occurring in the gaze. This isn't a staring contest. Blinking is allowed. Step 6. No talking. After the 10 minutes are up, you can decide whether you want to share your experience with your partner. Sometimes the conversation seems like a natural extension of what you just experienced. And other times, it feels right to give a hug, acknowledge each other, and let the encounter be what it is. Old Buddhist teachings tell us that we're all mirrors for one another. Seeing the truth of our inner landscape reflected in the eyes of those around us. But it's easy for this to go in one ear and out the other. After a few eye gazes, these words will mean something entirely different to you. Chapter 11. Breaking Down to Break Through. There came a time when staying tight within the bud became more painful than the strain it took to bloom. Anais Nin. November 12, 2010. Loreto Province, Peru. There are three levels of personal wetness during the rainy season. The baseline is damp. Every morning, you wake with some degree of moisture in your bedding and perspiration in your undergarments. The first few days are an adjustment, but after a week or so, it just is. The next, and in my opinion, least desirable of the three tiers of personal humidity is moist. Moist is when you're walking through the jungle with some type of waterproofing layer on, trying hard to remain only damp, but failing at it. Half of your senses are clinging to the patches of torso that are still holding out against the encroaching drips down your back while you plod on toward a semi-dry shelter. Resistance is futile. Then there's soaked, the point past which surrender to the elements is the only option left to you. Water has overwhelmed your defenses and claimed every inch of your body. The only useful clothing left to you are your knee-high mud boots, which are at least keeping your toes from plunging into whatever might be hidden in the mud underfoot. Oddly enough, once you've flinched and shuddered away the discomfort, soaked is not a terrible place to be. Soaked is the state of the crew and me as we plod through the forest in the direction of Hut 7 on day 29. With only 2 days left in our healing retreat, we're making rounds to each of the patients to conduct final check-in interviews and document how far they've come. The day started off sunny, but the skies opened up about 2 hours ago, and we've been swimming through the bush, doing our best to keep the equipment dry on the sprints between huts. We just left Hut 4, where Melinda surprised all of us with a very vulnerable and honest summary of where she is in her process right now. I am no shaman, but the spiritual transformation in her is obvious. She came into this journey as an overly confident natural health maven who had all the answers. The kind of person who tells the doctor what is wrong with her, and only occasionally hears the advice she's being given by the professionals she has put her trust in. When the shamans attempted to dig into the shadows that were looming in the form of self-distraction mechanisms, inner narratives, and an overly dogmatic approach to her spirit path, there would always be a subtle bob and weave on her part. But over the past 10 days, something has shifted, and the 58-year-old mother of two has become silent and introspective. She was a hard nut to crack for the first few weeks, but the jungle has brought her into the embrace we've seen in most of the other patients. It's hard to say if Melinda's breast cancer has improved or worsened over the past month. The herb poultices that Edwin has been preparing for her haven't had any obvious effect on the growth of the tumor on the right side of her chest. The shamans were concerned when they discovered that she had already had a mastectomy to remove an earlier tumor in the same place. According to them, once the body has been mutilated, their word, or burned, using chemotherapy and radiation, it's much harder for the herbs and ceremonies to do their work. Melinda believes the treatment is working and asks if she can stay on for another 30 days. I tell her that I'll relay her request to Roman and ask him to come out and visit her. The answer is most likely going to be yes. The muddy path underfoot turns into a stream as the forest floor gives way to a steep downward slope pointing in the direction of Hut 7. John is our final stop. "Lens on camera 1 is starting to fog up," Brock, our lead cameraman, says, without the urgency that would normally be attached to a gear malfunction of this caliber. The mood today is light and happy, despite the torrential downpour we find ourselves in. After all, we're soaked, not moist. That, and the enlightened state of our fearless patients, has us all in high spirits. Plus, we've got another dry camera with us, and only 2 days to go. I haven't seen John since the San Pedro ceremony yesterday, which I left in dazzling fashion after nature called on me a second time. Nor have any of the other crew or staff members seen him, aside from Roman. The storm clouds overhead shed a false dusk on the stretch of forest ahead as we approach Hut 7. There are candles lit inside as we slosh up to the front steps. "John, are you home?"
"Nick! Dan, Brock, come inside."
The door swings inward, revealing a smiling John. "Please, come inside. You boys are drenched. Talk about dedication to the cause." John's lighthearted expression beams a three-dimensional luminescence against the dark and stormy jungle just beyond the window behind him. Dan glances at me from behind camera 2 with an eyebrow raised slightly off its perch, telepathing, "What happened to the grumpy old John, and who the hell is this?" "John," I begin, "the last time I saw you was in the Maloka during San Pedro ceremony. You seemed to be really..." "Yes," John interjects. "I know. I was shown parts of myself last night that I had long forgotten about. I've been scratching at this thing within me that is always just out of reach. I feel it in my periphery sometimes. A higher part of me that is yearning to be let back in." He's speaking with a warm smile, but his eyes become teary as he continues. "I can't even imagine certain aspects of yesterday." He pauses thoughtfully. "You know, it's just beyond comprehension, but I'm aware that it all happened, unfolded, and it was an amazing experience. I mean, my body begins to vibrate as I talk to you about it. You know, real vibration and other senseness of what's here." A huge smile creases his face as tears stream down his cheeks. He lets out a laugh.
"So, nothing much is happening for me."
"How do you feel physically?" I ask. "Do you think you've made any progress with your prostate cancer? I actually haven't thought about that in a few days. Dr. Patel ran another PSA test a few days ago, and I'm supposed to visit with him one more time before we leave. But after what I've experienced this week, I'd say anything's possible. He is moving around the small hut now, radiating with energy. I don't think I've felt this young since I was in my mid-20s. A weight has been lifted off me, Nick, almost as if something toxic or poisonous has been removed from my body. It's like Roman says, sometimes you have to break down to break through. I feel like the breakdown is complete, and now there are openings inside me where there once were not. The person before us looks the same as the old John. Same skinny frame, gray eyes, bald cranium with white hair around the sides. But this is a different man. Kind and youthful. Wise. Nick, I would like to stay in touch with you once we all return home. I think there are a few things I can share from my humbling experience here in the jungle that might be relevant to you. I have been where you are now, an intrepid explorer in my early 30s who is trying to do good in the world. I respect the path you are on, but there are many traps along the way that I fell into, and I'd like to help you avoid them. I am a little taken aback at my own role in John's narrative, and my surprise probably shows. Anyway, he continues quickly, let me know if that feels like something you'd be interested in. It was an idea inspired by the cactus medicine last night, after I came back. A few days ago, this idea honestly wouldn't have held much appeal for me. But the man is speaking truth and transmitting an essence in his demeanor that has us all in awe. That would be great, John, I reply sincerely. I'll take all the help I can get. Thank you. In 2 days, John will have his final checkup with Dr. Patel, who will give him some stunning news about his most recent PSA test. PSA stands for prostate-specific antigen, and the test is a standard measure used in modern medicine to screen for prostate cancer in men, usually over the age of 40. My father was diagnosed with prostate cancer using this method, and although it's not 100% accurate, it's helped thousands if not millions of men detect this condition before it's too late. When John arrived, his PSA levels were above 7.5, and his doctor had already diagnosed his prostate cancer using a biopsy. On the final day of the retreat, Dr. Patel will perform another PSA test, and the new results will show that he's dropped to 5.5. Although it's only 2 points lower, this is a sweeping shift on this particular test. A 5.5 PSA level is considered to be normal for men of John's age, and his doctors back in Australia will be shocked when they get the results. He is one of 5 patients who experienced a breakthrough with their illness on this trip. This statistic will become a catchy tagline for the Sacred Science documentary's film festival run. 5 patients will return healed, 2 will return disappointed, and 1 won't come back at all. Cue suspenseful music. Admit 1, your free ticket to watch the Sacred Science documentary. In the middle of an ayahuasca ceremony a few years ago, I was shown, quite bluntly, by a higher power, that the Sacred Science movie needed to be given away for free so that people of all walks of life, regardless of socioeconomic status, could witness the healing truths of these ancient traditions. We have since made the Sacred Science film available for anyone in the world to watch online at no cost. That includes you, dear reader. To date, the documentary has been viewed by more than 2 million people and has birthed its own tribe of conscious-minded individuals. If you would like to witness the transformative journey of our 8 patients, find out what happened to each of them, and learn more about the herbs that were used for their specific illnesses, please use the following internet link. There are no strings attached. You can watch it and share it with whomever you wish. The link to use is www.thesacredscience.com/TSSbook_movie-screening. Although the physical results of our patients are promising, they're not evenly distributed across the group. Some of these daring participants have experienced borderline miraculous recoveries from serious illnesses, while others are still struggling with their symptoms. But one extremely positive outcome has been reported by everyone. This past month, has given each patient a cathartic spiritual opening, more powerful than anything else they have ever experienced. Even those who are disappointed with their physical recovery thus far are seeing themselves and the world around them with new eyes. Many are reporting daily experiences of synchronicity and coincidence. The crew has been overwhelmed by it as well, to the point where it is no longer even spoken about. Unexplainable phenomena have become the new normal. John's breakthrough is not entirely unique. Other patients speak of similar realizations. Why haven't I let others in? Why haven't I been there for the people who are most important to me? Why these walls of separation? But John's description of feeling the need to be a lone wolf, rather than part of the pack, sticks with me. We Westerners have forgotten what it means to be part of a pack, and to let that pack take care of us. Of the startling transformations that have transpired in our month-long healing retreat, this one transmission will be my own personal catalyst. Science hasn't figured out how to measure or prove it yet, but we humans are more connected than we think we are. We've somehow gone down a road of separation from our loved ones, our neighbors, and ultimately, ourselves. And it's time to come back to our true nature. But we all have shadows we must first be willing to face. The following evening, every resident of the center is invited to a closing fire ceremony in a jungle clearing next to the Maloka. Dan and I fiddle with a camera next to a towering pile of dried wood, while patients, shamans, and staff situate themselves on random chairs and strategically placed logs. The feeling of this rare, informal gathering is lighthearted and bittersweet. The patients have come such a long way, and this is the first and only opportunity they will have to share their experiences and express their gratitude before beginning the long voyage home in the morning. Gretchen, whose debilitating IBS is now completely healed, smiles as she tells Nicola about her son Aiden, whom she misses immensely and cannot wait to see upon returning to Wisconsin. Jessica, still in the throes of her Crohn's disease symptoms, is explaining to John how she will be staying at the center for an extra month to continue working with the plants. He praises her for her bravery and takes down her information, promising to check in from Australia now and again. Juan is busy helping Edwin and Christiane lay a few more branches on the 8-foot-high pyramid of wood, listening intently to some instruction Edwin is giving him. He came here struggling with depression and substance abuse issues, but is an entirely different person right now. Not only are Juan's symptoms entirely gone, but he has realized his true calling, to be a healer. This week, the shamans made a special exception to the rules, allowing him to accompany them on their rounds each morning as they prepared herbal treatments and attended to the other patients. Last night, we visited Juan in his hut, and he opened up about his time here. "It's the most significant thing I've ever done," he told us. "Learning how to be at peace with myself here in the wilderness and keep moving forward through the pain and fear. I realize now that the issues we all have are not physical. We feel them physically. The disease comes out and we often experience it in a three-dimensional sense. But I see now that it really comes from here," pointing to his head, "and here," pointing to his heart. "Right? We create these things, and if you deal with them in here, then the physical symptoms will go away. That's what the shamans work with. That's what's going on in the jungle." The sun is fully set, and the conversations are illuminated by headlamps expertly pointed at the ground by each wearer to provide ambient lighting. The sea of stars above us shines brilliantly in the cosmos, a side benefit of being more than 500 miles from the nearest city. Edwin and Christiane are pouring some kind of liquid on and around the base of the stack of timber as Roman steps forward and begins to speak. "This is our final night together, here under the Amazon sky. The past month has been both challenging and enlightening for you all, but the true work has only begun. Everything you have learned about yourself, every layer of illusion that you have peeled away, every healing you have experienced is only as permanent as your daily practice allows it to be. When you return to the lives from which you came, The clarity you now have will be tested. This is not a possibility. This is a fact. The question is, can you walk through this world and hold on to what you have been shown? People with the experience of thousands of years have seen that each level of our personal evolution comes with its own pitfalls. The sacred science, the shamanic system of healing that you are immersed in right now, was brought forward from these native traditions as a beacon of light to guide us through the ocean of our subconscious so we don't get lost and forget who we truly are. You have seen each other laid bare in the face of the unknown and now know what's possible when we embrace the deeper parts of ourselves. You each have your own spirit path to walk, but it is our shared duty to stay awake and fully present with everything we encounter in our lives from here forward. Edwin approaches with a flaming branch and hands it to Roman. Listo, hermano. Roman takes the makeshift torch and turns back to us. This assemblage of dried wood behind me symbolizes all of those things within yourself that you have let go of this past month. All of the non-serving thoughts, the tall tales you have been repeating to yourselves about who you are, the traumatic memories of your past, the string of words and thoughts that were quietly imprisoning you. The shaman approaches the pile and touches the flaming branch to the outermost cuttings, igniting small patches of petroleum. The fire travels quickly to the center of the temporary structure, licking hungrily at each log, leaf, and twig as it goes. This flame is a symbol of the light of consciousness we all possess. It can transform the darkness within and without us into understanding and truth. The shadows we harbor are just waiting to be illuminated by this essential state of being, but we must be willing to hold the torch and explore every aspect of ourselves with an open heart. The fire grows taller and hotter behind Roman, reaching 15 feet upward into the sky. Crackling embers shoot out from the top and then float, dancing against the sparkling stars above. We sit in silence, transfixed by the burning form that is fast disappearing into nothingness. Looking around the circle, I see a collection of the bravest souls I've ever known. Facing our shadows. Consider them both, the sea and the land. And do you not find a strange analogy to something in yourself? For as this appalling ocean surrounds the verdant land, so in the soul of man there lies one insular Tahiti, full of peace and joy, but encompassed by all the horrors of the half-known life. Herman Melville, Moby Dick. One evening, in the middle of a coca ceremony with Roman, I came to a sudden realization and found myself speaking it out loud. I have an anger inside me that I don't know what to do with, I began. But I have a convenient victim complex that justifies the shadow. It tells me, yeah, maybe you have anger, but you needed it to get through life when you were younger. You had to learn to be tough and protect yourself. I looked across the tight alcove at the cross-legged shaman, who sat against the wall opposite me, and something in his face prompted me to continue. There's a built-in justification in the way I tell it. When I open up about this hot anger that I sometimes feel, I always lead with the fact that I was bullied when I was younger. Tell me about this bullying, he said at last. How old were you? Everyone enters this spirit path with their own set of skeletons in the closet that need to be removed in order to continue forward. Many of mine stem from unresolved strands of outcast consciousness from my childhood. When I was young, the simple act of going to school each day carried an extreme amount of anxiety. I never understood why, but I didn't have any friends from kindergarten through high school. Maybe it's because I had a stutter, or maybe I stuttered because I didn't have any friends. Either way, I was alone. I wasn't even nerd or geek status. I was an island unto myself in an ocean of kids who seemed to be thriving in their elementary and middle school environment. I could never figure out the friend game that everyone else was playing so well. My mom always used to tell me not to worry, that we Palizzi boys were late bloomers, and that it would get easier as I got older. It didn't, for more than 10 years. At lunch, most kids have a select group of friends they find in the cafeteria, and flock to like clockwork each day. That wasn't how it was for me. I remember the hot panic that would come over me as I loaded my lunch tray with whatever overly processed prison-grade gruel they gave us back then, all the while peering around the lunchroom looking for a safe place to sit down. A safe place could be identified as a table occupied by mild-mannered boys who wouldn't balk at my joining them. These were ideal. The less great option would be to find an empty table and sit alone. But that would often prompt taunting from kids at other tables, who astutely pointed out that I didn't have any friends. Sometimes, I just skipped lunch altogether. I had sweaty hands throughout my entire childhood. My notebooks and test papers were covered in cloudy black smudges where the side of my wet hand brushed across fresh ink or pencil lead. My fingers were almost constantly clenched into nervous fists, my jaw set tight. I can still envision the shiny micro-rivers of sweat that flowed through the creases in my palms nonstop. Things escalated in eighth grade, and there was some physical confrontation with a few different kids at recess. This is when I found out that I had a rage inside me. I was too embarrassed to maneuver inside the lunchroom, but when somebody was trying to physically force me into submission, something inside me would snap. Onlooking boys called it retard strength. Whatever it was, this reaction was an ally that got me through some tough situations. In college and my early 20s, the rage came in handy when I felt that friends were being harassed at bars or that girls were being disrespected. My wife Michelle even thinks it's kind of sexy. It still lives inside me, decades after my fighting days ended. And after the inner work I've done on this path, this self-defense mechanism still remains and is one of those core wounds that I'm in the process of healing right now. This is a blessing in disguise, Roman offered gently. It's a matter of taking responsibility and recognizing your power. The basic ignorance that I'm seeing behind the story you just shared is that you're bullying yourself, giving your power away, developing this conditioning of hardening rather than softening. The true strength is not in being defensive, keeping people out, being afraid of being taken advantage of, having this tough and strong attitude. The true strength is in remaining soft and vulnerable, having your heart open in all situations. Long ago, he continued, there lived a Tibetan saint named Milarepa, who also experienced much violence in his early life and was brave enough to face his shadows and work through each one until they were fully dissolved. To do so, he needed to learn to hold space for the darkness that had transpired in his life to such a degree that the greatest light was ultimately born from it. Roman then shared a prayer about Milarepa, which I will now share with you. Let your mind stay. I can contemplate the sky, but the clouds make me uneasy. Milarepa tells me how to meditate on clouds. If the sky is as easy as you say, clouds are just the sky's play. Let your mind stay within the sky. I can contemplate the sea, but waves make me uneasy. Milarepa tells me how to meditate on waves. If the sea is as easy as you say, waves are just the sea's play. Let your mind stay within the sea. I can contemplate my mind, but thoughts make me uneasy. Milarepa tells me how to meditate on thoughts. If the mind's as easy as you say, thoughts are just the mind's play. Let your mind stay within your mind. Shadow work is learning how to be free from fear and emotional blocks, not by avoidance, but by understanding them, by developing recognition of who you are and learning how to become a channel or a hollow bone. You realize that whatever you are feeling is just the clouds moving through the sky. They may be dark clouds, but if my true nature is the sky, I don't need to identify with the anger. It's moving through me. If you are completely open to any thoughts and sensations that are coming through you, then gradually you can recognize yourself as that pure, indestructible state of consciousness that cannot be affected or bound by anything. That's what fearlessness is. You know who you are. You know what your nature is. No matter what goes through you or happens around you, it cannot affect your true, essential state. This is part of doing shadow work, staying present, and learning how to maintain restful, heart-centered presence. Period. There are a number of practices that can help one work through fears and shadows, but meditation and a consciously lived life are the best teachers. Chapter 12. Wired for Tribe. June 19th, 2016, 5 o'clock a.m. Larapata, Peru. The sun is cresting the eastern wall of the Mapacho Valley as I wander through the morning mist along a footpath above the Paititi base camp. I can't sleep late when I'm in a tent, and this morning, the inconvenience is an absolute gift. My eyes are fixed on a few locals ascending an adjacent coca field with heavy bags on their backs. They move quickly, as if the 45-degree incline underfoot does not exist. How? A rooster crows somewhere down below. It's almost time to get down to breakfast, but I don't want to leave this spot. I stare up and realize I'm standing next to a huge vilca tree, the great-grandfather spirit of the jungle. Condor medicine. The Incan shamans used the seeds of this Anadenanthera colubrina tree in a sacred snuff that would help them transcend this world and enter the realm of the spirits. When the right dose is sniffed, the effects are extreme, starting with terrible pain in the head and then turning into what many consider to be an evil or dark realm of consciousness where death seems to be close at hand. This shadow state lingers for 10 or 20 minutes, finally giving way to something much more euphoric and light. Each of the major plant teachers in this tradition have a corresponding animal spirit. Grandmother Ayahuasca is often depicted as a serpent or snake. Grandfather San Pedro, or Huachuma, is connected to the puma. And great-grandfather Vilca is represented by the condor. Each of these creatures give us insight into the action the sacred medicine has once it enters our body, and the abilities it unlocks. Vilca is thought by many to be the ultimate plant teacher, often delivering those who are brave enough to partake into the heavens and then back again. A transmission runs down my spine. This tree relies on all its branches, leaves, and roots to interface with the outside environment in a harmonious way in order to survive and thrive. There is no one part that is more important than the others. There is no separation among its many constituents. Every inch of this vilca has an important role to play, and the health of the surrounding jungle depends on each tree like this one, living in full connection with its neighbors. We're not much different from trees in this respect. The system of life flow that is so essential to a healthy forest also applies to the two-legged mammals that walk the trails carved into its soil. It can be summed up in one word: tribe. To many, this word feels exotic, or of a different cultural ilk. But I think it's time we begin to bring the true meaning of tribe back into our modern lives. In today's world, our connection via the interweb does loosely match tribe's definition, a group of people linked by social, economic, religious, or blood ties. But for the traditional people of the world, tribe takes place in much closer proximity. It's the extended family, the community in which each member shares and cares for the others. In tribal societies, everything is shared. Successes, failures, responsibilities, leadership. No single life occurrence is too intense or overwhelming for an individual to handle because he or she doesn't need to shoulder the burden alone. For the Dagura tribe of Burkina Faso, for example, when a death occurs, the entire village joins together in a complex and beautiful grief ritual that lasts for several days. Support for mourners continues long after the death, as grief is seen as a community event. In tribal societies, success is also shared. No success is so large that a person's ego explodes, because accomplishments are the result of a group endeavor. For the Anuene-Nawe tribe of Brazil, the Yakwa ritual is a time for the tribe to spend several months fishing along the Amazon River by canoe, smoking the fish as they go, finally returning to their villages with sustenance to last for months. Everyone wins, everyone celebrates, everyone is nourished. Here, in the United States, our sense of tribe has largely vanished. Many ship their elders off to isolated retirement communities. We work our lives away so we can afford our private houses, our individual cars, our gizmos and gadgets that keep us disconnected from each other. Meanwhile, our children are growing up without the wisdom of their grandparents. Kids are left to their own devices, and these days those devices have screens. Many young people have swapped personal connection for an electronic interface. For an organism to function, all of its parts must be intact. If we look at our society as an organism, with a nuclear family at its core, all signs point to an organism that is disjointed and blocked. No one wants to feel like their lives lack meaning, like many of our retirees do. When tribal folks enter their later years, they make the natural transition from provider to wisdom keeper. It is their time to emerge as teachers, caregivers for children, and a grounding force for young adults and parents. Their role shifts, but they are just as needed. Children of the tribe have two or three generations of role models, each with their own unique life perspective to bestow. As a parent, I see how important my son River's relationship with his grandparents is. They teach him a way of being that I simply don't have access to yet. It's magical and profoundly fulfilling to watch them interact. This is just a glimpse of what is possible when we humans live in a fully interconnected way. So many of us feel alone and overwhelmed in our lives, even though we have loving friends and family. Could it be that we need community in order to share this human experience in a more meaningful way? I believe that tribe is the prescription for many of the pitfalls in the modern world. But to obtain this antidote, we must learn how to be in relationship with one another again. With our families, with our neighbors, and spreading outward from there. Over and over nowadays, I hear the same message. Our needs and the needs of our loved ones are not being met. The irony is that our needs are all connected. The need of grandparents to have meaning can be fulfilled by bringing them closer to the family and their grandchildren. The need of parents to have support and some time for themselves can be accomplished by the same act. Our children's need for human connection, attention, and mentorship can also be filled by bringing back the tribe. There are so many inefficiencies in the way we've set ourselves up, they just don't make sense. If we are open to their wisdom, the indigenous tribes of the planet and the forest itself have a lot to teach us. Dogs in Peru and the rest of Latin America are wild creatures, mostly left to their own devices. if you've traveled through Mexico and the countries that unfurl as you navigate southward, you've probably had some encounters with street dogs. They're a little nippy, usually crossbred, and often in need of several baths. But they have an unusual intelligence, not seen in most cul-de-sac dogs in the States. And although their mutt pedigree would keep them light years away from best in show, they are beautiful and resilient animals. These pups all seem as friendly and innocuous as domesticated pets, but it's clear that in fact they have no owners. You see them lying around on the cobble streets in the morning, soaking up the sun, then wandering over to the cooler stone threshold of a shady doorway during the hotter hours. In the morning and at dusk, you'll see them roaming solo or in packs, on the prowl for food, mating partners, and a little extra adventure. Yes, they're mangy and flea-ridden, but they sure seem content with their lot in life. A few months ago, I was at a wedding in a pocket canyon in the Sacred Valley, about 3 kilometers up the mountain from the small Peruvian town of Lamay, when I spotted a mutt wandering through a bull pasture. My friend Mark and I immediately recognized her from a trek we had taken a few months prior, about 20 miles north of where we were standing. Quiet but joyful, this brown and scrawny lab mix loped over to us and lay down at my feet, resting her head gently on my left boot. Within a minute, she was sound asleep. I was amazed and grateful to see her again, and somewhat shocked that she could have found her way so casually through these harsh mountains. What is the range of a South American street dog? It's not unusual for a gray wolf to travel up to 20 or 30 miles in the course of a day, but we don't tend to ponder the roaming radius of a domesticated or semi-domesticated canine. Maybe the magic of these Andean strays is that they're a combination of domesticated and wild, able to abide by the rules of a human home, but also tough enough to survive in the outside world for weeks and months at a time. By contrast, I have a purebred French bulldog named Oscar back at home, who is loving, playful, always hungry, perpetually farting, and a champion snorer. We love him to death, but he wouldn't last an hour on the streets, let alone in more rugged terrain. When Michelle and I first moved in together in New York City about 8 years ago, she insisted that we get a dog, and specifically a purebred French bulldog. She wasn't 100% sold on me as her permanent life partner yet, so even though I was not a firm believer in the majesty of mutts at that point, saying no to her was not in the cards. My only condition was that I got to pick out the dog. One rainy afternoon, we took the Q train out to a breeder in Sheepshead Bay who had advertised a few pups for sale on Craigslist. The adorable pictures and official logo on the webpage looked pretty legit, but we found ourselves standing outside a rundown walk-up under a subway overpass, ringing the bell beside a beat-up black door with the house number scrawled across it in what looked like white chalk. The man who answered the door was nice enough and led us upstairs to the second floor, which was brightly lit, with freshly painted white walls, some official-looking signage, and a makeshift front desk. He asked us to sit down on a nearby IKEA couch while he went and got the puppies. I scowled at Michelle and said something about this being a bad idea. Then the breeder returned with 2 tiny handfuls of fur and wrinkles. He set the 2-month-old puppies on the floor in front of us, and any semblance of grouchiness or concern I might have harbored about getting a purebred dog evaporated instantly. The burrito-sized Fuzz brothers were so tiny and innocent, but they already had their own character and disposition. One was more cavalier, padding over to a basket of dog toys and jumping into it with reckless abandon. The other just sat there staring at us with big eyes, sizing us up. The pup in the basket was yipping and yapping away, but this one didn't make a sound. He just watched us. His brother got bored with the toys he was chewing on in the corner and turned his sights on us. Springing into action, he ran full tilt and barreled into the pup right in front of us. But the calmer one reacted in a split second, rolling with his brother's momentum until he was on top, pinning the ball of fur and teeth to the floor almost effortlessly. A moment later, he was back over at our feet, studying us, occasionally licking his paw, while he glanced over at the disinterested breeder at his desk. "We'll take this one," I said, affirming the choice that had already been made by the puppy at our feet. And that was how Oscar came into our lives. He was only supposed to grow to 25 pounds or so, but he now hangs out around the 40-pound mark, give or take a meal or two. He used to be the most athletic French bulldog I had ever seen, able to chase down frisbees in midair, and sometimes beat more conventionally agile dogs in short sprints at the park, until he reached the ripe old age of 6. While playing with another dog one day, Oscar took a short tumble down some steps and knocked one of his vertebrae out of alignment. This type of fall wouldn't have affected most other dogs, but we soon found out that French bulldogs are known to have misshapen spines caused by extreme overbreeding. The average lifespan of a Frenchie is 10 years if it's lucky, but those later years are often quite a struggle. Through centuries of husbandry, these creatures have been carefully mutated into their present form, with attributes that please us aesthetically but leave them hamstrung in terms of basic survival. Their bodies are now so out of whack that they can't even reproduce without human assistance. It's hard to believe that Oscar and all domesticated dogs are direct descendants of Canis lupus, the gray wolf. Dog is man's best friend, but maybe he's also a mirror, reflecting in full detail how we've bred them and ourselves away from our innate, primordial origins. Drawing comparisons between dogs and people, or puppies and children, is not a very popular thing to do at cocktail parties. But this book isn't politically correct, nor ought it be. I'm looking for truth rather than accepted fact, and some of our cultural norms must be put aside to get there. We've domesticated the dickens out of our dogs and cats, and whether we'd like to admit it or not, we've done the same to ourselves. What is at the core of this way of thinking? Control, predictability, possession, domination. These four words are cousins to a four-letter word that begins with F. It's something that we must come to terms with and constantly overcome on the spirit path. Fear. In many cases, fear is healthy, if not vitally important. Without it, I would almost certainly have perished by now, and the same goes for you, whether you acknowledge it or not. Fear is our friend, as long as the frequency and dose are right. Looking at the prevailing news headlines and the decrease in social behaviors that indicate trust in strangers, like hitchhiking for instance, I would say, as a society, we are overdosing on it. Like Oscar, we are all bred and trained to live within a cultural and technological context. This has its perks, especially when you're taken out of the food chain as a young pup. But what would Oscar do if we left him outside to fend for himself? He'd die within a few days unless he found another household to take him in and put food in his bowl. What would happen if technology as we know it failed? If the entire power grid of the East or West Coast were knocked out and electricity, internet, and cell phones were shut off? What would the fallout be? How many of us would survive? Would you? I can almost guarantee you the indigenous folks of South America would. And don't think they're technologically inferior because they have cell phones and computer access too. They simply haven't forgotten what it's like to be a human being in a natural environment. Raised to trust their instincts, to learn from direct experience with the outer world, and to be tough. Amazonian and Andean folk are not dependent on much besides Mother Nature herself for survival. They are sharp, filled with grit, and perhaps most important, contagiously happy with comparatively little. This disconnection from our natural environment shows itself in other ways too. We suffer from back problems caused by sitting for hours each day, and eye problems from a lifetime under fluorescent lights, staring at computer screens and televisions, passing our time watching actors portray fictitious events, and newscasters blast our brains with overly sensationalized, fear-based renditions of world events. There is a void inside us that no amount of network television, binge-watched sitcoms, or video games will ever fill. Something primordial is crying out for deeper connection to others and to the ground beneath our feet.